Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, named after the fictional small town found in several of author Michael DeCamp's books. This podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll hear interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, performers, and entrepreneurs, sprinkled with friendly banter about any number of topics, all of which attempt to view the world through the lens of creativity. Turn up the volume and enjoy the latest conversations in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the, well, maybe it's not welcome back, but welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm Mike DeCamp, one of your two wonderful hosts, and I'm here with...
Nancy DeCamp. Hi, everybody.
Great. The other wonderful host. And we are happy to be with you today, and we're going to have some fun coming up. Nancy's going to kind of take the show on it a direction, and we will enjoy what she brings our way. In the meantime, we're going to start like I usually do with some creative indulgences.
Oh.
Nancy.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I think you know that if you talk to us, probably one of the creative indulgences you're going to hear about is books, because we are book lovers. And I read a book recently that I had picked up when we were on a little holiday in Tennessee called The Invisible Hour by Alice Hoffman. And it's not that long of a book. It's less than 300 pages, but it just drew me in. And one of the things on the cover that caught my eye, even still, Steven Spielberg had read it and was like, drew him in from step one. So I'll read you the synopsis from the back, okay? And it was a Goodreads choice and nominee for best fiction, just as a FYI. It says, one June day when Mia Jacob can no longer see a way to survive, the power of words saves her. The Scarlet Letter was written almost 200 years earlier, but it seems to tell the story of Mia's mother, Ivy, and their life inside the community, an oppressive cult in Western Massachusetts, where contact with the outside world is forbidden. But how could Nathaniel Hawthorne have captured the pain and loss that Mia carries inside her? As a girl, Mia fell in love with a book. Now, as a young woman, she falls in love with a brilliant writer as she makes her way back in time. So there's some time travel here. But what if Nathaniel Hawthorne never wrote The Scarlet Letter? And what if Mia Jacobs never found it on the day that she planned to die? Let me tell you, it was just a fascinating story. There was some time travel involved. And at the end of it, it gives different books about the author because it intertwines some with Nathaniel Hawthorne and his life and the writing of The Scarlet Letter, where you could read, you know, it recommends, obviously, read The Scarlet Letter, which was a requirement when I was in high school. But it also had lists a couple other books about his life and then the life of his sisters who were known at that time as well. But I'm thinking it was a little over 250 pages and it was really a page turner and a very interesting story. So I highly recommend. That's been my most recent wow kind of creative indulgence.
Very cool. Very cool.
How about you, Mike?
Well, you know, before I go into mine, I just want to bounce off of something that you just said, talking about the Scarlet Letter was a required reading when you were in high school. Mm-hmm. I hear that from people. You know, I had to read this in high school. I had to read that in high school. It's usually one of those classic books, and Scarlet Letter is one of them.
Yeah.
I don't know what was wrong with my high school, but
well, now,
I don't remember ever having a required book in high school.
Here's the question, though. Were you enrolled in, like, AP or advanced courses? Because maybe that's where there were some unique courses that were what they would consider AP. Or in my high school, we had one that was kind of a little bit more advanced or got more in depth with things. And it was called HISLish, where they matched history and English together. So there were some different approaches. And I would say it was in those classes that I was exposed. Mm-hmm. Or you might hear, especially some of my friends out there that went to school with me, you might hear,
maybe
we had to read Moby Dick. We had to read this or that. And that might be the difference.
Maybe that is the difference because I think, you know, when I got to high school, I took a number of English classes. I took, English 101, English 201 or whatever. I took Greek mythology. I took, Shakespeare. I took some of that, but I think by the time I got to my senior year, I had enough credits to graduate.
I'm done.
And I just kind of backed off.
Yeah,
I didn't take the tougher classes. And so that maybe that's where I missed out on those.
On those. And I will say, now, in full transparency, when I was in high school, I read some of the books we were required. I read a lot of Cliff Notes for the books that were required. But it made me think, oh, I'd like to go back and, you know, maybe read The Scarlet Letter now that I've read this book, and then maybe some of the other books about the author. I did another series like that. My sister-in-law has shared with me. I can't think of the name of the books, but it was by Hemingway. There was a book about Hemingway, and then it had you read a couple of books. So it was written about him during a period of time that he wrote a couple of books. And so there was kind of like a two or three books that you could read, and they were all intertwined. And that was an interesting approach to that reading. And I would equate that with,
you know, wouldn't it be so cool if at some point in time, like 30, 40 years from now, that they have a AP English class somewhere that's on Mike DeCamp's
books? Would be very cool. I don't think I'll be here to see it, but that would be very cool.
No, if we're still around 30, 40 years, we're old.
Yeah. All right. So tell me about your creative indulgence, Mike.
Well, I got two books. You know, Nancy says that we're book lovers, and we really are. I think that we could almost make this podcast about books. But there's lots of book podcasts out there, including, you know, the last podcast we did was with Nikki and Crystal.
Right.
And that's all their book.
Right.
That's what their podcast is about. But when I was on my epic 2-week driving adventure this summer, which, you know, for folks out there, if you haven't heard about that, we did a whole episode on that back in the summertime. When I was on that trip, I stopped and saw my friend John Goodman, who was also in a previous episode. He's a financial planner, but he's also a friend of mine. I stopped and saw him in Bozeman, Montana. And while I was there, he handed me a book. He gave me a book, a gift. And the title of the book is Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of American Leadership by John Noke. And that's spelled K-N-O-K-E-Y. And this is basically about the life of Theodore Roosevelt up through his presidency. And Theodore Roosevelt's one of those presidents I've heard about my whole life, and usually in very positive terms, speak softly and carry a big stick. I think that's one of his,
Bit more brazen.
Yeah, it's a little brazen, but I don't know if he ever really spoke softly. That's the interesting thing about it. It's a saying that if you read this book about him, he was pretty brazen in all of his approaches. But I was really taken with how he was kind of like a bull in a china shop in a lot of the organizations he was in, including the New York legislature. He was started out there. Yep, he was police commissioner in New York City.
Yeah.
Or one of the commissioners. And he was... he was governor of New York for a while. He had the Rough Riders in Cuba, so he became a war hero.
Right.
And then he became president when President McKinley was assassinated. So, and then as president.
Yeah.
So he was very, very brazen and very straightforward, you might say, and kind of like, okay, let's knock these walls down. But the thing I was taken with him was that he always did it with a very... kind of a selfless purpose. He had high ideals, and he didn't like corruption, and he wanted to tear down the walls of corruption. He wanted to create a system where people got jobs in government service because of their merit, not because of who they paid
right.
or who they supported.
Who they know, yeah.
And
where's the connection?
So he was very selfless in how he approached it. But I thought it was a very good book. I would highly recommend Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of American Leadership by John Noke, K-N-O-K-E-Y.
Yeah, I think that's one I want to read. I think I shared on the podcast at some point in time, I read a book called If a Poem Could Live and Breathe, and it was a novel of Teddy Roosevelt's first love. And so I always thought of Teddy Roosevelt as that rough writer, you know, outspoken. I mean, goodness gracious, he got shot one time and continued even after being shot with his... political speech that he was doing.
Yeah, he went on and finished it. He went on into the hall and did his speech for almost an hour while he had a bleeding. Bullet.
Yeah. So I always thought of him as that brazen kind of guy. But this, the novel that I read, they have actual artifacts. It's actual letters that he and his first wife, Alice, wrote back and forth to each other. So it was before he ever had any political aspirations, what they were able to put piece together about the person he was. And that changed my perspective a lot about him. And I think because it had the actual letters and we have those, it gave, I guess, some credibility to the story. So it was something that I really enjoyed learning about him. Yeah.
And it was very interesting. He was so heartbroken when she died.
Oh, yeah.
That he would never talk about her again in the future.
Yeah.
He just could not talk about
her. I'm like, man, what a great love.
Yeah.
So anyways.
The book I'm reading right now is kind of like I'm back on the fiction side. I'm reading Stephen King's collection of short stories called If It Bleeds. There's 5 stories in there, including another Holly Gibney story, which I think that's the If It Bleeds one. And I just, you know, the first story I just read is Mr. Harrigan's Phone, which they turned into a Netflix movie. So I'm back in the Stephen King world. And obviously that gets creepy. And I enjoy his creative stories. So far, Mr. Harrigan's Phone was entertaining.
Yeah. Well, good.
Who knew that an Apple phone could be creepy, but
I can tell you a million ways it could be. But you know, the thing I think about is that's what makes these indulgences, right? They take you outside of the everyday, whether it's nonfiction or fiction. You're looking at another person's life or a place in history, a time, a scenario, or you're taken into a make-believe story. And I don't know. I find that enjoyable.
Absolutely.
Good. Right. So, Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit? You've been having a lot of book activity, but you've got quite a bit coming up. What do you have coming up here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, before I get into that, I'm a little update on Doc Moon Book 2. So, as you all know, I released the first book in the new Doc Moon series last fall, which was called The Purveyor of Death. Gotten really, really good reviews. In fact, I'll share the most recent one with you. It was
a good one.
Yeah, this was a good review. She found me at the Barnes & Noble in Greenwood, Indiana. I had a day set up with Barnes & Noble where I basically had a little table and I was talking to people about books, and she bought The Purveyor of Death. And this is what she had to say. "I'm usually hesitant to try authors I don't really know, but DeCamp was doing a book signing and I never had been to one before. So I looked him up and his books and read the reviews, and it piqued my curiosity. So I went and had him sign one for me and went home and started reading. And I have to say, wow, it has everything that I as a reader would want. It keeps you wanting more. I got to the point that I couldn't wait to read the next page. And I fell in love with his little town and all the people, wishing I could go there. And Doc, I absolutely love Doc. If you're looking for a book that never gets boring and is a short read, you need to go pick up one. I highly recommend." So obviously I found a fan.
You found a fan there. And I will say, I'm a fan of the Doc Moon and looking forward to, because you've been working on the next
book. Yeah, I've been working on book 2, and I'm getting close to finishing the story. So my process, folks, if you're just kind of tuning in, my process is I lay down the whole story and I write most of it. And then once the story's complete, I go back and I go through it again and I add detail and color and tweak things and fix things that are inconsistent. And I go through the whole story again. And then eventually it works its way to beta readers and my pro editor, and then the final edits before it goes to the publisher. But writing the first full story is the biggest chunk of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost done with the full story for book 2, and I'm getting kind of excited.
Good.
I'm actually picking up a little bit of speed. So maybe I'm hitting my groove.
I was going to say that makes a difference. Get into that sweet spot as a writer, right?
Yeah. So that's an update on Doc Moon book 2. I don't have a title for it yet. Usually that comes to me, but it hasn't popped into my head
It'll
yet.
It'll come at the right time.
But yeah, I've been doing a number of activities. Probably the most recent ones, we did a book signing at Fallen Leaf Books in Nashville, Indiana.
Yeah.
That was really cool. I took my own inventory of books and they sold them through their register.
Sure. But you got to meet a lot of people that day.
Yeah, I did. And they have some of my books there.
Okay, so if you're visiting Nashville, Indiana in the near future.
Yeah, go check out Fallen Leaf Books. Ask about Mike DeCamp's
books.
Very
cool little independent store there.
Yeah, it's a great little store.
Yeah, about a block off the main drive. And
very easy, very good people to work with.
Yep.
Then I got an opportunity to set up in the Barnes & Noble in Greenwood, which is where that reviewer came
from. You've been there a couple times.
Yeah, well, I did my initial book launch there for The Purveyor of Death last fall.
Yeah.
I did a follow-up, I think, in November last year. Two signings, and they sold out all of the books that they brought in for me. So they let me come back again this fall and had my full gamut of books. Of my fiction books.
Where they brought them all in and you just showed up to meet people and sign.
Exactly.
And awesome.
That worked out really well. So they've let me reschedule. I'm going to be back again on January 3rd at the Barnes & Noble in Greenwood.
Well, fun. Indiana. That'd be a fun thing if you're in the area and
come
something
see me.
Post-holiday to keep your
Between now and then, I believe that this episode is going to release in time for a couple of days left on my next event, which is the Christmas Gift and Hobby Show in Indianapolis at the State Fairgrounds. I'll be one of the authors in the author booth at the Christmas Gift and Hobby Show. So you can come see me there.
Yep.
After that, I've got Christmas in Wanamaker.
Oh, you've done that before too. That's a nice little event.
That's on December the 6th. I'll be set up there all day. And then December the 13th, I'm excited about because that's actually going to be in my hometown.
That's going to be in Muncie.
So you Muncie listeners out there, I'll be at the Book Center, which is in the White River Plaza. At least right now, they're getting ready to shut down there and move to a new location. But they're still going to be there, and I'm going to be set up from noon to 5 or 1 to 5. I'll have to check that. But I'll be
I need to look at my social media to confirm.
Yeah, look at my website. It's on there. But I'll be there all afternoon signing books and talking to people, and they're going to sell them through the register there. So
a lot of activity up through the holiday season.
Yeah. And then, like I said, I'll be back at Barnes & Noble on January 3rd.
Yeah.
So
good.
I'm hoping to do more Barnes & Noble, and if I'm really lucky, my fingers crossed, maybe a Books a Million or two in the upcoming year.
I think it's neat that you've gone back to see if you can do some things like that in Muncie, because everybody loves hometown guy done well or accomplished something. So to be able to go up and have some book signings and interact perhaps with, family and friends or what have you or others.
It's interesting. Muncie obviously is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And Muncie does appear in the Cutter's Notch series of
books.
That's
true.
And it does appear in a couple of the short stories. Mm-hmm. So
makes sense.
And, I've caught some references in Doc Moon that kind of, not directly Muncie, but kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to me. And Muncie, I still love Muncie.
God bless you.
I know. You don't feel the same way necessarily, but
I don't have harsh feelings against Muncie, but it wasn't my hometown, right?
Yeah, it was my hometown.
It's your sentimental attachment.
I have a
there.
Soft spot. I may make fun of some things like, oh, that's my Muncie math coming
in.
Yeah. But it's home. Still love Muncie. So I'm excited to go back at the book center and hopefully maybe if I'm really lucky, there's a Books a Million in town there and I'm hoping to do a
So you're talking there. With them and
I'm
such.
Talking to them.
And I know you have some fans in Muncie. We know some people there who have already purchased this stuff, but I think it's kind of cool for you to have some opportunities to go
So
back
if
there.
If you're in Muncie and you go into the Books a Million and say, hey, do you have Michael DeCamp's books? let's prod them a little
bit. If you've never been to Muncie, here's your chance. What's Muncie, Indiana really like? Why?
You can go to the Red Dog Saloon and get a tenderloin.
Or go to the Pizza King. We can give it to all kinds of creative places.
That's my update on the books.
Awesome.
So Nancy, I think I'm turning it over to you now. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, today we got to thinking about a lot of different things And one of the things we thought about is we are in the middle of what we would call the holiday season. You know, once fall hits, you start thinking Halloween, you've got Thanksgiving, you've got Christmas, you've got New Year's. I really feel like the, you know, October, November, December fly by fast. Now, holidays can be great fun. And I think we all have fun or interesting stories from our holidays, which I thought we could share some today as we talked about the holidays. But they can also be a challenge for people. Either they're a challenge because maybe there are difficulties in family-friend relationships, but yet you, by whatever reason, you get together as a family, you know? And so I thought it would be great if we talked about the holidays. We'll start with Halloween, even though it's past Halloween at this time, but just kind of talk through the holidays, talk about some of our memories, talk about some creative aspects or approaches that either we've experienced or we see people doing, and maybe make some recommendations how to creatively deal with challenges, be it challenges in relationships, challenges in time to get around and connect with everybody, and challenges even with money, because it can be scarce at times. So how do you meet all the holiday expectations or change those expectations? So with that, let's go ahead and talk about Halloween a little bit, Mike.
Oh, that's scary.
Now, here's a question for you. Did you always purchase Halloween costumes, or did you make Halloween costumes growing up?
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid in Muncie, first of all, we had two nights of trick-or-treating.
Wow.
So when I was a little kid, if I could talk my folks or my older siblings into it, we would go out both nights and collect bags of candy. So I had a nice stash to last me for a little bit.
Yeah.
We always bought my costume. Mom didn't make him. Dad certainly didn't. But we would go by, and it would be Superman or Batman or whatever, Dracula. But it would be a plastic face mask nylon get together. And hopefully I wouldn't have to wear my coat over the top of it, because it would.
Yeah, because sometimes like it could snow. It could get cold.
And it seemed like all the time it rained, too. It either snowed or rained. Yeah. It's like, geez, why can't we just have a nice Halloween, right?
Yeah. So
like the one we had this year. It was really nice here in Indiana.
Yeah.
But what about you? Did you make yours, or did you?
You know, I can remember having a few store-bought ones, like when I was really little, like kindergarten, first grade. But after that, we started creating them. And my mom always had she called it the rag bag. So if there was a shirt of my dad or my brother's or of hers or some other piece of clothing or linens that were no longer really usable for their purpose, they went into the rag bag, and you would use them, as you would expect, for rags. If you were cleaning or, you know, wiping oil off of a car part or something. So we always went to the rag bag, and then we would figure out, well, what buttons, notions, paint, whatever, what, and how could we create? So we created most.
You
Halloween
did that
costumes.
For our girls when our girls were little, well, too. Yeah, you made almost all of their costumes.
Yeah, I did.
I love the picture with Angela and Andrea in front of the tree.
Yeah,
I
mean, always save that one. Angela's like a hippie, 70s hippie, and Andrea's Queen Amidala.
Yeah.
And we, you know, did her face all up, and she was like, that was one of my favorite costumes.
Yeah.
I mean, one time we joked to Angela one time, was like Elizabeth Bennet. You know, we made her like a Victorian kind of dress. It was a hint at a Victorian. I am not a seamstress, so it was a hint. You had to have a creative mind to see some what those costumes were. But I even helped. I knew some friends. I feel like our friends, the Millers, their son wanted to be a Power Ranger. And I remember going over to their house and helping him to create, you know, his Power Ranger costumes. I liked doing that kind of stuff. But as we've talked on this podcast before, one of the creative things we've done, I didn't do this year, just didn't have the time and energy, is I find that people aren't trick-or-treating as much in neighborhoods. I've talked to people around and say, do you see this so much? Because they're all doing the trunk-or-treats. And so traditionally, I have always, even in the last few years, I'd be like, oh, I'm just too tired, I can't do it. And then I'd come up with an idea at the last minute, and I would do the trunk-or-treat. And we've done things. You've been Darth Vader, and I was Princess Leia, and we had a spaceship above the trunk and such. We were pirates and in a pirate ship last year. I think I shared we were clowns and a jack-in-the-box, and I would pop up and such. And That was always fun. I always say, give me some cardboard, duct tape, and paint, and I could make about anything.
Man, I'm telling you, that clown one was off the hook. And we were both face painted and wigs, the whole deal. Yeah,
our daughters came over and helped us paint our faces. And I mean, it was a family affair to get ready for that
one. It was almost as much fun for me just driving to the trunk or treat in the full clown getup.
Yeah, people would look at us in the car.
I wanted to walk around the neighborhood, but Nancy was afraid somebody would shoot me or something, I think. But.
Yeah, yeah. Because that was the thing about that trunk or treat. The kids, they thought it was great. The parents were freaked out about us being clowns. they've seen it, right?
Let's face it, clowns are creepy.
They certainly can be. So that makes me, we were talking about Halloween recently. You were telling about a story with your dad uncharacteristic Ralph DeCamp.
Very uncharacteristic for Ralph DeCamp. Ralph, if you knew Ralph DeCamp, my dad, he was a factory worker for many, many years. He had been in World War II. He was very reserved and quiet, spent most of his days
very smart.
In retirement, very intelligent. Mm-hmm. He spent his days reading or watching baseball, you know, after he retired. Mm-hmm. And so he was just not this out of the box, like crazy creative
person. Not the party guy that you would think he's going to get it started.
We couldn't get him to go on vacations. You know, it's like we had to drag him on one vacation that we took to South Dakota.
Yeah.
And so he just was not the kind of person you would expect this out of. But when I got to be about 12 years old, remember, we had two nights of Halloween.
Question for you.
Yes.
Pause this story. When you did two nights of Halloween, did you wear the same costume both nights or did you do different costumes?
No, same costume. Okay. We only bought one.
Yeah.
It's the only one I had.
I didn't know if you swapped around with other people or whatever.
Oh, gosh,
you know?
No. But we would do two nights of Halloween. And so I would go trick-or-treating the first night. And when I got to be about 12, the second night, I would hand out the candy on the front porch. And so we'd have the porch light on. Little kid comes up, knocks on the door, trick or treat. I open the door, give him a treat. You know, we're into the evening. Time is going by. Kids are coming by. And there was this knock on the door, and I walked over to hand out candy. And it was looked like a kind of a larger, like maybe a teenager. And I opened the door to give him the treat, and they grabbed me.
Oh, my gosh.
Scared to living.
Did you scream?
I'm sure I did. I was like, just grabbed me and pulled me out of the door. And I'm like, I was terrified. It was my dad.
he'd definitely gone out of character.
Yeah, very, very much so. He'd gone out the back. He'd snuck out the back door. He had covered himself, dressed himself up like I don't know what. He was completely covered up. And so I didn't recognize him at all. Scared to living. Whatever out of me, it makes me want to say words that I don't generally use.
That makes me think about, in terms of a creative addiction. I don't know if it's a creative addiction, but
addiction
sometimes.
Addiction or indulgence?
Yeah, indulgence, right? It depends.
Could be an addiction.
It's like looking at, I'm big at looking at Instagram reels. And one of the things that I love is the reels where like the wife or somebody scares, like they're just standing beside a door and they jump out and the other person's like, whoa, and jumps like crazy. Those things crack me up. I don't know why, but
the ones I love are the ones where the two people are together and one of them acts like something is about to happen. Like, you know,
and then the other one just freaks out. Like, what is it? What is it?
Yeah.
Those are good.
Yeah. I enjoy those.
I'll share one piece of creative approach to Halloween out there. I don't know if this will help anybody in the future. So, in the last two places we've lived, we have not had hardly any trick-or-treaters.
Nope.
And so, but you want to be prepared because I had one year where I wasn't prepared and we had somebody show up and we're running around in the pantry.
Which used
to
be really nice because I would eat all the candy.
Right. But then I got to the point because we are wanting to be more health conscious and I don't want to have candy. I don't want to start in October and eat all the way to the new year. I don't mind some treats, some indulgences. But so what I started doing is I will buy one bag of candy, and usually it's simple, like Hershey miniature bars, right? So it's just chocolate. And I don't open the bag unless a trick-or-treater comes. Because if the bag opens, we're eating it. But if we don't have any trick-or-treaters and I don't open the bag, I can use that chocolate for when I do baking and candy making for the like Christmas holidays.
Right.
So that's a creative thing you could do. You were like, oh, I want to be prepared. I end up eating the bag every year. I don't want to do that. Don't open it. grab, buy one bag, but make sure it's something that you could use. And there's other types of candies that I use in my holiday baking. You could just buy that. And then guess what? You've already pre-bought for
that,
your baking.
Folks, that bag got me in trouble this year and I was innocent.
Yeah. I came home with the shadow, the way the light was. I need bright light to see.
She went to the gym. She left the chocolate bag next on the chair by the front
and
door.
And I was don't open that unless somebody comes. You know, I'm being the sergeant.
Came.
You know,
nobody came. So the bag stayed in the chair the whole time. And then she comes home from the gym and she's like, I told you not to open that.
Yeah. And it wasn't open.
Like, I didn't open it.
Oh, like, okay. Sorry. Sorry. So that's Halloween. Halloween can be fun. It can also be kind of scary and not so fun. People actually play pranks that are not nice, but.
Oh, yeah. And dangerous sometimes.
Yeah, can be. So let's move on into the Thanksgiving era time frame.
Yeah.
There can be challenges with Thanksgiving. You've got to travel. You have multiple places to go to, or you're hosting, and there's a lot that could be done. Let's talk about some Thanksgiving memories and about some, along with that, some creative things that we've done, experienced, or could share with.
Yeah, you know, that's always difficult for new couples, right? Because every family has their own Thanksgiving tradition. And
yeah.
Usually it involves Thanksgiving Day.
And they can conflict timing-wise and approach. Yeah,
very much so. And, you know, with Nancy and I, she was from Indianapolis. I was from
Muncie.
And so, you know, going to both places on the same day could be a little problematic.
And then you have extended family too.
Yeah. And then, you know, Nancy's family started having Thanksgiving every other year. They would be, well, what the compromise was, we started doing a family Thanksgiving with Nancy's family all together at one of her brother's houses.
Outside of Indiana.
And then the in-between years, we would have Thanksgiving with my family.
So we didn't force having Thanksgiving with every family
every year. Right.
That seemed to relieve a lot of stress for us.
It relieved a lot of stress for us. I think there were maybe
discouraging, right? That, oh, we're not have the typical tradition. We're always getting together, right?
Yeah.
But it made it easier. So I guess I throw that out there because whether you travel, we had to travel because my brothers lived out of state, but it makes it easier if you have multiple places to go because maybe you have each of your families and then you have in-laws or your parents have divorced. So there's, you know, maybe four families to go to and stuff. How do you negotiate? Like, I think one of the groups in our family, their opposite side, so mom's side, they always do it like a day later or on Saturday after Thanksgiving. That's their tradition. And that's a way that they have kind of compromised to not run everybody ragged. Because you think about Thanksgiving Day, if you're going to multiple places and eating every single time.
Yeah.
You're miserable. Do you really enjoy
Yeah.
everything?
you can't take the time to relax with your family. You've got to think about what time do I need to leave to get over to Aunt Josie's house or whatever. You know, you're kind of on edge.
Right.
In a lot of ways. So it's like, and I think about, you know, broken families or just non-traditional
extended
stuff where mm-hmm. there's like, there might be, like you said, three or four houses.
And it's very common. Very common.
It's really tough. Some of you folks out there who listen to the show, just for curiosity's sake, if you want to drop us an email at michael@authormichaeldecamp.com, just maybe tell us what your situation is, how you deal with it. How have you creatively dealt with it? If you care to share.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's tough. I think we did the whole split thing every other year.
For several years. And then we kind of fell off because my family, some dynamics changed in the family, not because we didn't want to get together, but some dynamics changed. And then
that's the thing. Things morph over the years.
They
right?
do. You know, you the patriarch, the matriarch maybe pass on and change, you know, things shift and change. It's funny though, with my family, there's more people involved traditionally because there's, you know, my nieces are all married and they have kids and they're all over the country and what have you. So when we do get together, one of the things we like to do is to, when I grew up, you had the adult table and the kids table. Did you guys?
No, well, we only.
You didn't do Thanksgiving in the same way that
we did.
Yeah,
we didn't have one big table. I think, you know, the adults as a kid, I think we a lot of times we would just make a plate and go sit wherever.
Yeah.
It's like we didn't really have an official Thanksgiving table.
Yeah. Well, that's what even other meals when the family was together at my parents' house, you had the adults table and then in the kitchen was the kids' table. Because like you said, there wasn't one big, large dining room or whatever. So it was always a big deal when you got to move up from the kids' table to the adult table, right?
Right.
Well, within my extended family, we love to have everybody in the same room at one table, which can be a challenge when you're talking 30 people.
Right. Or so, the last time we did it.
Yeah, tell them about that.
We had like 35. I don't know. It was a huge gathering because we had Nancy's family, almost all of them there. And we had my family, the ones who still come to Thanksgiving.
Yeah, the ones that were here in town.
All of them were there. And we set it up in our family room, moved all the furniture back.
Moved the furniture out.
And we had this, I call it a Tetris layout. Nancy had designed it where the tables kind of zigzag looped around yous. And we got everybody in the same room around a table.
Yeah.
It was, if we had to rush out of there because of a fire, it would have been
a challenge.
It would have been a challenge because we were like zigzagged into those tables. But we got everybody in and we all had this one big giant table of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
It was. Cool. It was. It's a big effort. And luckily, everybody pitches in. So you get through. But one of the things I'd like to talk a little bit about is some creative things. Because when I was growing up, if we had Thanksgiving dinner that we went to or hosted, you went to the kids' room and played or whatever. You entertained yourself. You're out in the yard messing around. But it seems there's more of a trend to have things to entertain while you're together.
Yeah.
So you're not just sitting around watching the football game or you're not, what have you.
And when I was a kid, the kids all went to the basement where they could breathe and all the adults were upstairs smoking.
Back in those days, everybody was smoking. So you retreated somewhere and played, but I have found that the culture has changed and you need some activities. So one of the things, it's kind of been a tradition that my parents started when we had family all together and they happened to be at my house several years ago. My dad made some marshmallow shooter guns out of PVC pipe. And so we had a marshmallow war backyard. And I tell you, I found marshmallows until May.
Oh yeah.
In the house. Because they came in the house. Yeah. They dry up and be under.
And you know, ants don't really like marshmallows.
No, they don't.
Because there were all marshmallows outside all over the place for months.
Everywhere. Outside, inside. And I cleaned my house. It wasn't like, there's another dang marshmallow. And after those were kind of gone, I happened to find at some dollar store or something, some marshmallow blow guns and bought them. And so when we get together, like my family got together last year and we got together in North Carolina, we got one huge house on the beach. And so there was one day we took the kids out on the beach and they had their marshmallow war, which was fun because a couple of the dads of my nephews have military background, are in the military, and they were doing all this kind of tactical moves with the kids and stuff, which is pretty hilarious. But that's become kind of one of the things that we do just to kind of burn off energy. And
I got a kick out of the last time we had everybody together at our house when you did the whole Tetris table. We had those little kids.
Yeah.
And Angela got them doing Google Eyes.
Oh my gosh. Eyes. Yes. She bought a bag of Googly Eyes.
We had googly eyes on everything in the house. Yeah. Last summer when we were moving, we were still finding things with googly eyes on.
Yeah.
Light switches, toilet tanks, paintings, there were googly eyes everywhere.
So that's maybe a fun little creative craft that does it. Now, mental note, don't put googly eyes on a picture that does not have a glass front.
Right.
But is maybe actual paper that painted or whatever, because it will mess that up. But light switches, lamps, glass, pictures that have glass on them, like the girls' graduation pictures, they had googly eyes and such. Uh-huh. And the kids just thought that was hilarious to be able to do that.
And for months after that, when I would find one, I'd take a picture of it and text it to the parents.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll share this with the kids kind of thing. That was fun.
Oh, that was fun. Yeah. And we remember the year we left Muncie, we had Thanksgiving. Angela was just a baby. We left Muncie late on Thanksgiving Day and we drove to, where was it your brother was living? It was in Connecticut.
Angela was only 5 months old at that time.
Yeah, we drove with the baby We stayed somewhere in Eastern Ohio and then got up the next morning and drove on to their house on Friday morning.
It was a long drive.
And Angela, as a 5-month-old, started crying.
She was only tired in that little car seat, bless her heart.
And the only way we could get her to stop crying was singing the same song over and over. Yeah. Down in the valley.
The valley's so low. and she'd quit crying and she'd calm down and we'd get quieter and then we'd stop. As soon as we'd stop, for hours, we sang that stupid song to console that poor tired little baby.
She got what she wanted though.
Or what she needed.
Yeah. So what's next?
Well, I would say other kind of fun family activities, and they don't have to be at Thanksgiving. I will say one creative thing I did at Thanksgiving. I do love Christmas.
She does.
And one year while I think the girls might have still been in college, I put up the Christmas tree before Thanksgiving.
That's right.
And it was like, oh, how dare you? But I bought some orange and burlap kind of ribbon stuff, wrapped it around. And then I bought, you don't have to buy, you could cut out some leaf shapes. And so throughout the month of November, whenever someone would come over, I would have them take a Sharpie and write on a leaf something they were thankful for and put it on the tree. So on Thanksgiving Day, anybody else who hadn't been over, they had opportunity to do it. So we had a whole tree full of things that people were thankful for.
Our Thanksgiving tree.
Our Thanksgiving tree. And I thought that was fun. And I was telling somebody about that this last week at work, and they said they had a friend who... they'd bought a pumpkin and had it for decoration. It was a pretty big pumpkin, but it wasn't one they carved out like a jack-o'-lantern. And she said what they did is they took a Sharpie and the parents and the kids wrote on the pumpkin something they were thankful for. And then when everybody came over, they did that. And then that was their centerpiece on their Thanksgiving table, was the pumpkin with all the things. I thought, well, that's a creative idea too.
I used to try to get everybody to share something they were thankful for right before the dinner. The problem is if the group is too large, your food is completely cold.
That can be a challenge. So I think that's a great thing to do, but maybe think of the timing or when.
Yeah, the
when
timing
that hits.
And when you do it. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I loved that Thanksgiving tree though. That was pretty cool.
Speaking of trees, and one time this wasn't a Thanksgiving thing, but something certainly you could do. I had bought just small canvases. Maybe I don't know if they were 5x7 or 8x10, but they were small little canvases, inexpensive ones. And I took some black paint and made just a basic tree, you know, the trunk and some branches that went out. And then when everybody's together, I had paints and everybody put their thumb in a particular color and went around and put that on the tree branches. And then took a black Sharpie, a fine point, and I think they wrote their name. And so everybody went home with a family tree, and it had some saying on it about, well, though we're spread apart, our roots are always together. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the family went home, the tree of everybody's thumbprint and a colorful like autumn tree. And that was kind of fun.
Well, speaking of painting and Thanksgiving, last year when we were at the beach, we had the entire family on a long table and we sat across from each other.
You had
and
to
we,
draw numbers to get a partner. So you didn't know who your partner was going to be.
That's right. You didn't, you know, it was randomly selected. And then you watercolor painted the person sitting across from you. And I got to tell you, mine was the best.
It got the most laughs. I will say that.
It did. It's a good thing I wasn't feeling particularly sensitive that night.
It was funny too, because one of my nieces, she pulled our daughter Angela's name, who Angela is trained in arts. And as soon as she pulled her name, she was like, yes, I'm going to get a good picture. Because most of the pictures, you had to go in it with humility, because nobody's going to be looking good, because none of us are at that level of a portrait artist.
Except for Angela,
right? But it was hilarious. I was like, I've got that on the docket to do with my friends sometime. I think that would be a fun activity. But
none of them will want me.
Based on what you do. I don't know.
But actually,
I don't know.
I liked it.
Well, good. Good. Good for that. Well, let's move on from Thanksgiving then. And let's talk about, seems like the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas is fast.
It is.
And there's always lots of things to do, could do, need to do.
Parties,
friends, work, family,
shopping.
I think we overdo it. Maybe try to make things simpler. Mm-hmm. It's easy. One of the things we've done, the girls introduced us to an app called Giftful. And so with this app, you go on and you create your own little wish list. And you can even link it directly to, I want this towel from Target and pull it in there and you can give a description. I'd like the green towels, whatever. You can put your sizes in, and you kind of have friends or people that you share your list with. Now, if Mike has a list and the girls and I see it, which this is where it's really helpful, I can go out and I can click on one of his items and say, I bought this book for him. The girls will see it, but he doesn't see if somebody's bought something. So it prevents you from double buying, right? Because we've seen
duplicate gifts.
Yeah. Seems like you see duplicate gifts every year. So I thought that's been very helpful, but you brought up a point about one aspect that you're not sure you love about it.
Well, you kind of know if you know people are buying off that list, then you kind of already know what you're getting for Christmas.
And
I kind of like the complete surprise.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe there's a balance. Maybe you can get some of them off the list and then some of them that aren't on the list just to keep it fresh.
Yeah.
And keep the surprise going. But you mentioned about the duplicate gifts, and it reminded me of a story from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Can I share that?
Oh, yeah. I think I know what story this is going to be.
my sister had a husband who he was there with us for a number of years for Christmas, but he wasn't the most popular person in our family. Let's just put it that way. But he loved Blue Stratus cologne.
Do they even make that anymore?
Who knows? It's probably the off-brand market.
Yeah.
But my sister told everybody that Lewis loved, I said his name, but I'm not giving you his last name. She said that he loved Blue Stratus cologne. Everybody bought him this is back when everybody bought for everybody.
Right.
Literally everybody bought him a bottle of Blue Stratus cologne. He got something like 8 or 10 bottles.
More than a year's supply.
Somewhere, someplace is probably a still existing bottle of Blue Stratus cologne that was bought for him in 1978. Whatever year that was.
Yeah.
But he, by the time he opened the last one, I think he was getting kind of ticked off. And then there was the gift that was bought for my sister, and she was really scared of spiders. And somebody bought her and wrapped it up a bag of plastic spiders.
Yeah, she didn't like that gift, did she?
She didn't like that gift. And she looked directly at me and at David, her son, and was mad at us.
Nobody claimed it.
And he and I were both like, we don't know. We didn't do it. And you know what? We didn't do it.
Sure, Mike. Sure.
You got anything you'd like to confess, Nancy?
No.
Okay. Well, fair enough. What's next?
Well, the other thing I thought of in terms of Christmas is that one year we had made the decision that the big Christmas gift is we were going to take the girls on a trip and leave the day after Christmas.
Yep.
And we wanted to spend most of our Christmas budget on that trip to adventures and things.
It was a big trip.
It was a big trip. And so, but yet it's always good, especially for girls. They were freshman and senior in high school, but mm-hmm. even, you know, it's good for kids to give. They need to understand how to give. And so they, you know, of course, like gifts. So what we indicated that year, since we all love to read, is we bought each other books, and that's all we bought. So we could like take them on our holiday with us and such. And we didn't search around. And that was, I don't know how you felt about it, but that was one of the best Christmases ever. It was like low stress. It was something I loved.
I absolutely loved that particular gift plan. It did simplify my world. I only had to go to the bookstore, and figure out what books I wanted to buy for everybody. But we do all love books.
Yeah.
And we knew we had this big, it was like a 2-week trip planned to someplace really special.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to keep the money set aside for that trip. And it all worked out really, really well. It was a special time. We still had our Christmas morning that we always have.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't forego any of our special stuff.
Yeah, we had our
treats. We just cut down on all the spending on gifts.
Yeah.
And saved it for our trip. So I thought that was a great idea. And I think, was that your idea, Nancy? Is that
I don't know how it, I think it might've been we all, you know, talked about it together and came up with.
Somebody had to.
Because I think my idea, knowing me, was like, we just won't do gifts for all our holiday. It'll be our, you know, it's like, not exactly.
The one who loves Christmas the most was kind of being Scroogey. Is that what you're saying?
I'm just trying to direct our funds in a particular way. You know, speaking of books, it makes me think about a book that I read. And if you've never read this, there's a movie out on it as well called Skipping Christmas. John Grisham actually wrote that book.
Yep.
And the premise of the story is there's a couple who
The movie is called Christmas with the Cranks, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
The premise is a couple who are empty nesters and daughter is gone, lives across the country, won't be home at Christmas. So they're like, let's go. They're going someplace tropical. So they're not putting up their holiday decorations because, and the neighbors are giving them grief.
And that was a big deal in the neighborhood.
That was a big thing in the neighborhood. They all had their decorations and it was a competition and all that. They weren't making all the food to wear the sweaters and have the open house and all that. And all of a sudden it was almost like 24 hours before they were to leave. Their daughter says, guess what? I'm coming home.
And they're like, uh-oh, now we got to get the whole place ready.
Yes, but they're not ready. There's a scarcity of all the favorite food and wine items in the store they're fighting for. They don't have the decor up or anything. And the cool thing that ended up was that the family, all the friends and family members ended up pitching in food. They brought, even though they tried to steal some of their neighbors' decorations and stuff, the neighbors came in and pitched it because it was for the daughter, the sweet girl in the neighborhood that everybody loved.
They didn't do it for the mom and dad.
They
didn't do it for the
mom and dad. They were ticked off at them, but it's a fun story. But we chose, and I will thank my family profusely, to skip Christmas a couple years ago.
Yes.
My mother had passed away, and because my birthday is on Christmas, it had always been a very special time, right? And I was like, you know, that first Christmas, I felt like I just can't deal with Christmas. And so I asked my family, would you be willing? And so we left Christmas Day. And so our Christmas was, we went to the Bahamas to an all-inclusive resort for a week. That was different. I enjoyed it, but I think we missed some of the traditions. It met my mental and emotional need that year.
Well, I think that's something for people to learn. You know, there are times when a holiday can be a particularly heavy time.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not always happy. And
It's meant to be lighthearted and special and joyful. And, you know, you think Christmas is all about the coming of the Lord and, you know, as a baby and it just all
and
that.
Santa Claus and Rudolph everything happy and fun. And
But when you have a heavy time in your life and there's a loss or things are particularly weighing on you, maybe that's not the time to try to pretend to be joyful when you're not feeling it.
It's and okay to grieve. It's okay to be sad or feel your feelings are your feelings, right?
And your family needs to give space for that. Yeah. And I think our family gave us space, gave you space.
Extended family, as well as you and the girls, supported me in what I needed that year. Now, I would say one of the fun things was, because your birthday is shortly after Christmas.
Yes.
As I found a t-shirt and it has a big white spot on blank square on it, rectangle. And it said, it's my birthday, sign. What did
sign,
it
say? It's my birthday, sign my shirt.
Yeah. So he walked around the resort with a Sharpie. He made so many friends and so many people signed his shirt.
Random people wanted to sign my shirt.
Because we were still at the resort on his birthday.
And some of them were like,
you're weird.
No, I mean, it's probably a little bit of that too, but there were a couple of these young women that signed my shirt and then wanted to kind of like do a little dance for me. I'm like, no. My wife is right over there. Maybe we shouldn't do that. But it was kind of a cool experience, though, having random people want to sign my shirt. Yeah,
meeting.
I still have that. There's some space open on it. So maybe I'll wear it this year.
Well, there you go. We can go out on the town. Yeah, get another one. That was fun.
Well, I think that would be fun for anybody on their birthday.
Do you think it's important for you to hold to tradition on holidays like Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever?
Yes. But I think it's also important to have a sense of flexibility for family as things begin to morph. You know, my Christmas was always, Christmas Eve was family, and all of my immediate family, my parents, grandchildren, my siblings and their kids, they all came to our house for Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And as we got older and the parents moved out of their home, we started having it at our house. We still, everybody came to our house with my parents, but eventually my parents passed away and things began to morph and part of the family stopped meeting with us.
Yeah.
And you just got to leave room for things to morph over time.
Be flexible
because as families grow and change and shift, there's going to be some changes to the traditions. And mm-hmm. so you try to hold on to what's important. And I think this year, one thing I will say is things are rough out there in attitude wise when it comes to the United States with so much angst.
You have extreme opposing views.
And they're very, very, very strong right
now. Yeah. And so you have people who are challenged financially.
Yeah.
By some things that people have lost jobs or maybe lost some benefits or are challenged. Even in good times, there are people out there that are challenged, right?
Yeah. And what I'm trying to say is that when you get together, try to set the views aside and just embrace one another as family.
Well, it's about connection, right?
Yeah. And there are things that are more important than our politics. There's the love for one another, the relationships with one another. It's something that should transcend. And so try to set those feelings aside long enough to embrace one another and love each other through the holidays.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Well, and it's more than politics. There are other things that play into that too.
Yeah.
You know, other personal choices.
But this year is particularly strong with that particular topic. And
yeah, I'm just saying that there's more. That might not be the only thing that's affecting your family.
Right.
It could be that there's strain because of some strained relationships or life choices.
There's always that wild hair uncle that's going to push the buttons.
What's that Christmas Vacation movie with Chevy Chase? That's always a wild one in terms of family. Yeah, family dynamics there. So
yeah,
finding ways to find abundance of love and sharing versus scarcity and, closing off.
Yeah.
Because we have, to my knowledge, but one life here on this earth. So I heard a recent doctor talking about longevity. And one of the things that stuck with me, and it sounds kind of morbid, but I thought it also recenters you. He said people should spend more time writing their eulogy with their life than their resume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just really resonated. I know my family will be like, yeah, I've heard it 10 times already. But it really resonated with me because it's like, yes, I mean, yes, you want to do a good job. You want to have a career. You need to invest. You need to, grow. That's important, but it's not more important than the life that you build. And that can be involved in your life. What you do in your career can be part of your life, but there's nobody at your funeral that says, man, they were a great project manager. You should have seen the way she worked in Excel. Uh-huh. It's not, it's about the relationship. So I think to your point, be it politics or other past hurts, constraints, challenges, you need to recenter and think if I walk away, what do I want to walk away with people feeling when I've been with them? And the holidays provide the opportunity. They provide the challenge, but they also provide the opportunity to create some connection.
And some great memories.
Yeah.
Some really positive memories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's time when you pushed all the chairs back and everybody had a dance party.
Yeah.
That was one of our favorites.
We did that at your parents' house on the Tetris year with my family a few years ago. We did that one night. Everybody was, tables were all gone and we're out dancing in the middle of the family. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was just fun.
Well, before we bring this to a close, do you have anything for New Year's?
Well, I will say you and I have not tended to be big New Year's people, have we?
Not really. I kind of like just sitting at home and having a quiet evening, watching maybe some music and maybe the ball drop. Yeah. Nancy goes to bed early.
Of course. I celebrate Australia, New Zealand. Oh, no, I celebrate Australia New Year's.
Yeah.
I don't go to bed early. I just celebrate
early
internationally. But I will say growing up, one of the creative or fun things we did is I would have a New Year's Eve party at my house as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Most of my friends, for the girls too.
Yeah, we did that for the girls. But with my parties, most of my friends, because I was in marching band, we're marching band people. Guess what we did at midnight?
Oh, you marched down Barth Avenue.
We broke out the instruments and we marched up and down the street at midnight. Instead of going out and banging pots and pans, which I'd done that as a kid, but throughout high school, the neighborhood got used to the marching band was going to be going up and down the street for New Year's, celebrating and ringing in the New Year's. So that was fun. If you have any musician friends that are willing, and neighbors who are amicable and willing to that kind of disruption.
You know, when I had a completely different experience with New Year's Eve when I was a teenager, because I was very much into church. Mm-hmm. I was a church kid. My family wasn't, but I was.
You didn't have other sports. You were like a sports manager or stuff, but you didn't have another activity like musicals or band.
I tried to do some things in sports when I was a freshman and sophomore in high school, but I didn't succeed. So let's not talk about that. That was a failure in my life. But New Year's Eve, I was very much into my youth group, second half of my high school years. And the church we went to had a Friday night New Year's Eve sing.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily Friday night, but it was a New Year's Eve.
Yeah, I said Friday night. Sorry, it's a New Year's Eve sing.
Yeah.
Any whatever night that was on.
Yeah.
And so everybody in the whole church would get together on New Year's Eve and we would sing from 9 o'clock to midnight.
Yeah.
And we'd take a break in the middle, have some snacks and treats and stuff. But
basically
we're singing for almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
And at midnight, you know, when the new year broke, we would break up, we would close it. And then almost everybody went to a local bowling alley at 1 o'clock in the morning and we bowled
for hours
from 1 to 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And then a lot of times we would go out to the Big Wheel restaurant on Madison Street and have breakfast at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And then I would go rolling into home somewhere around 6 or 6:30.
Party, Mike.
And I look forward to that every year, even as a teenager.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting time. It was different than probably what most people's New Year's Eve.
It was a fun way to celebrate. Cause when I went to college at Ball State, I was going to that congregation and I went up, even though it was holiday break, I went up to be able to participate and stuff. And it was fun. I love music. So the singing part was pretty awesome. And then going bowling with friends and, laughing and cutting up,
There's a whole story around the New Year's Eve sing that ties into Nancy and I's very first date, but that's a whole nother story. Cause I asked her, I said, are you coming back to Muncie for the New Year's Eve sing? And she wouldn't answer.
I don't know.
And finally she's like, why? I said, well, because your birthday's the 25th. Mine's the 30th. If you come back a day early, we'll go out to dinner. We'll celebrate our birthdays. If you don't come back to Muncie early, then we won't go out and we won't celebrate our birthdays.
There you go, gentlemen. The real savvy way to ask a woman out on a date.
not my best, but it worked.
It worked.
It worked. She likes the straightforward kind of thing.
I guess. I think there's a lot of ways you can approach New Year's. Some people do like to go out and I've known people who've gone and there's like packages so that they go to this buffet and dancing and then they stay, have a room at the hotel so they don't have to travel after being out late and stuff. And I think that's a cool way to approach it if you like doing that kind of thing, right?
I'd like to do that with you, Nancy, sometime is for us to, have some New Year's thing and then we have a hotel room somewhere so we don't have to worry about driving.
Yeah.
We can just
that's my aversion to being out on New Year's Eve as well as like 4th of July. I always say on New Year's Eve, you get the amateur drinkers out. So the people who don't typically drink and don't know how to handle liquor, and then they get behind a wheel. So I feel like it's not, maybe I'm being a little nervous about it, but it's like, I just don't want to risk.
Every year you hear about it.
Yeah.
Every year. So people out there, if you're listening to this, be wise. Be wise on New Year's Eve. Be wise on the holidays. Don't overdo the drinking and then think you're going to drive. Don't do that.
Yeah. Don't drink and drive. And don't drink buzzed or drive buzzed either. Because I've heard people make that excuse. But the other thing I would say, I've known some people who they don't do the New Year's Eve thing, but on New Year's Day, we had family friends that they had a New Year's Day party every year where they had all kinds of soups and sandwiches and cards games and the ball games on the TV and stuff. So you don't have to do late night thing. You could do a New Year's Day thing. I think the important thing on all of these things is to find ways to connect, to find ways to have a generous heart towards people and not stress yourself out.
Make positive memories.
Yeah.
And don't get to the point where you can't remember what you did. Otherwise you're not making, if you do that, you're not making any memories. So make positive memories.
Yeah.
All right, Nancy, time for a random question.
Random question.
You get to draw
it. I get to pick it?
All right, she's drawn one out.
I've drawn one out. I have to answer it first. What would a typical day look like if you were a billionaire?
Oh.
Sorry, company. I wouldn't be working for you anymore.
That'd be end of your
career. That would be end of my career at my current location, which I've been at for about 23 years. I think that I don't know that it would look much different than what it is, aside from not working. I think what my kind of, as I think about what would life look like if I wasn't working, like shouldn't at the point in time I retire, what have you, what kind of things would I want to be involved in? I think in my retirement years, I want to keep up on physical activity. I like going to the gym or doing some physical activity. I like working with nonprofits and volunteering. I would probably do that. Finding ways to help people and create connection. But I don't think I would choose to live differently. I would not go out and buy a boat. I would not go out and buy another home. That's just me. I think I would live pretty much the same and find a way to make a difference in others' lives. What about you, Mike?
I think if I were a billionaire, I think there'd be a couple of steps in the process. I think, first of all, I would get some real input on how to stabilize our lifestyle. So, in other words, plan for where our finances need to be over the next 20, 25 years, 30 years, however long we think we're going
to
live.
$1 billion, do you think you have to plan much?
It's a step. Well, so let me work through this, okay? Don't jump ahead of me. So I think
If I want to jump.
Well, yeah, you can do what you want to do.
Go ahead.
So, you know, I would stabilize a plan to make sure that our life is stable. But that would only take a minuscule part of that $1 billion, right?
Yeah.
So, and then maybe I go out and get myself a new pickup truck, or I go out, maybe we do get a vacation home somewhere we can go hang out at. That would still take just a minor part of that. And then I think I would spend my time trying to find ways to make a positive difference in the world. And I think because at this point in my life, I don't care about making another $1 billion. If I had $1 billion, I wouldn't care about making another billion. What am I going to do with it? I can't take it with me.
Your daughters are like, we have ideas of what you could do with making more money.
I'll pay off your student loans. But you know, that's it. But one of the things I often wonder is how many billionaires would it take to end homelessness? Right? So maybe I find something like homelessness or something like that, and I begin to work and address that subject with the money I have available. And I use that money to make a positive difference in my community and in the world. I think we have enough billionaires. I think Elon Musk right now is looking at becoming our first trillionaire. You know, if folks like him would take their money and utilize it, we could end homelessness this year. There is a way to do that. Now, you couldn't end it for everybody because sometimes it's personal choices that put people out there. So it's not
things. Yeah, you can't force it on somebody.
It's not an easy answer in every situation, but you could end the crisis.
If it was dependent on money,
you can end the crisis.
Could something be fixed, whether it's homelessness, food insecurity,
right,
healthcare, whatever.
Yeah. Right. You can end the crises that we have over some of these things. So I would probably spend the vast majority of that money trying to find a way to make a positive difference. I wouldn't loan it to anybody, but I might give some stuff away.
The question wasn't, what would you do if you were a billionaire? What would you do with that money? Like? What would your day look like?
My day would look like looking for ways to make a difference and working within the communities to do that.
Yeah.
So that's what it would be. Okay.
Well, this has been a long conversation. I'll just close out my two-piece. Or my
two cents,
and say thank you, listeners, for listening to us. Thank you, family and friends, for the support and the fun that we have had through holidays over the year, and wish all of you, whatever your holidays are, that you can find connection and find ways to really spread love and kindness, generosity to each other, not necessarily through money and materialistic things, but in ways that make a difference, and wish you all the best and look forward to talking to you in 2026.
Absolutely. And I echo what Nancy has just said. I will say, folks, that this will be the end of this season. This is the last episode for this season of the Cutter's Notch podcast. And I hope you've enjoyed this. I guess you would call it a holiday special. We will be taking a short break in creating new ones, and you'll hear us again at the beginning of 2026. Our first episode right now, it's planned to be our annual year in review, and we'll bring in our girls to have our annual review of things that we did and enjoyed in books and movies and whatever else that we talk about from 2025. So that'll be our first episode in 2026. And we'll work at lining up some new guests, but that will be the plan. And so you'll hear from us again in January. So, folks, thank you again for joining us on this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast, and we will see you or hear from you really soon. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Your hosts have been Michael and Nancy DeCamp. Michael is the author of several fantasy thriller novels and short stories that can be found on Amazon or ordered through your local bookseller. Visit www.authormichaeldecamp.com to learn more. His most recent release, The Purveyor of Death, Doc Moon Book 1, is a classic young adult horror novel and the first book in a new series. It's guaranteed to keep you turning pages. Nancy is Michael's number one fan with a love and appreciation for creativity everywhere. The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. Subscribe to catch each new episode as it drops. You can reach us by sending an email to michael@authormichaeldecamp.com. Join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.